It's almost an all-out war in 1970, once again between Arab and Jew in the Middle East. It was not just the Middle East that threatened to boil over. The dangerous situation could easily lead Russia and the United States on a collision course. During the late spring, United Nations mediator Gunnar Jahring, with the help of a 90-day ceasefire plan by Secretary of State Rogers, initiated Mideast peace talks.
I have pleasure in announcing that the governments of Israel, Jordan, and the United Arab Republic have each appointed representatives for the discussions to be held under my auspices for the purpose of reaching agreement on the establishment of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, and that these discussions will begin on the 25th of August, 1970, at New York.
But less than a month later, Israel pulled out of the talks, accusing Egypt of building up missiles along the Suez ceasefire zone. There were many airline hijackings during 1970, but none so spectacular as the forcing of four Western airliners to the Mideast, and were a contribution to the outbreak of a bloody civil war in Jordan between King Hussein's army and Palestinian commandos. One of the jets taken by the commandos, a giant 747, was blown up on the ground in Cairo just seconds after the crew and passengers scrambled out. The passengers and crew of three other jets spent almost a week in the Jordanian desert until Arab political prisoners were released from European jails. Then on September 28th, at the age of 52, Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, died. His death would leave a political void throughout the Arab world for years to come. Another powerful world figure died in 1970, Charles de Gaulle, Le Grand Charles, as he was called by his French countrymen. He was buried in mid-November with world dignitaries bidding farewell to a hero of the 20th century. The political kidnapping became a major weapon in 1970. There were eight major political kidnappings in South America and Europe. Three of the victims, including American advisor Dan Mitrione, were killed by their abductors. In Canada, political kidnappings brought about a major crisis in October. Quebec separatists abducted the British Trade Commissioner, James Cross, and Quebec's Labor Minister, Pierre Laporte. The ransom, 23 jailed separatists and $500,000 in gold. The Canadian government refused to give in. Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau mobilized troops and imposed Canada's drastic Warm Measures Act, under which hundreds of separatists were arrested.
Nothing that either the government of Canada or the government of Quebec has done or failed to do now or in the future could possibly excuse any injury to either of these two innocent men. The guns pointed at their heads have FLQ fingers on the trigger. Should any injury result, there is no explanation that could condone the act. Should there be harm done to these men, the government promises unceasing pursuit of those responsible.
Labor Minister Laporte was killed. British diplomat Cross was freed. Three kidnappers were granted safe passage to Cuba. And late in the year, three others were arrested for the murder of Laporte.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit and we have liftoff at 2:13. The Saturn V building up to 7.6 million pounds of thrust, and it has cleared the tower.
It seemed like just a few moments, perhaps, for at least a short period of time, people around the world felt as one when Apollo 11 landed men on the moon in 1969.
Altitude at this time. 13 Houston, go at 30 seconds. Roll complete and we're pitching.
But just months later, to a sophisticated United States, the successful landing of Apollo 12 seemed like a rerun. I've seen this before type of feeling. Apollo 13 would be different. The Apollo 13 moon mission in April was a space drama that held the world in suspense. Taking off from Cape Kennedy were astronauts John Swigert, James Lovell, and Fred Hayes. Everything went well until the last lap of the three-day journey to the moon.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main beam bus undervolt.
Roger, main
13, be under Volt. Okay, stand by, 13, we're looking at it.
Okay, right now, Houston, the voltage is looking good. And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there. And as I recall, Beam B was the one that had a amp spike on it once before.
Roger, Fred.
An explosion in the service module snuffed out almost all of the oxygen in the power supply in the command ship. The lives of all three astronauts were in grave danger. They had to get back to Earth, but how?
We appear to have had some kind of accident in the region of the fuel cells and the oxygen tanks. We've begun to use the LEM as a device for keeping oxygen in both the command and service command module and the lunar module, and we're using the power system from the lunar module.
In the scheme of going across to the lunar module, still connected with the open tunnel, the lunar module would serve as a sort of lifeboat for the crew of Apollo 13. Sometime later in the mission, it is expected that they would return to the free return trajectory, which they left yesterday in the mid-course correction burn number 2. At the Paracynthian near the moon, they would use the descent propulsion system of the lunar module for trans-Earth injection burn at about 79 hours, 30 minutes ground elapsed time. At this point in the translunar coast, it is cheaper and swifter to coast on around the moon and come back to Earth than it is to do a deep space abort.
They did use their lunar module as a lifeboat, using its water and oxygen. First, a trip around the moon, then the long journey back to Earth, a three-day journey of unnerving suspense and human drama. Finally, half a dozen days after they had blasted off, astronauts Lovell, Hayes, and Swigert splashed down in the Pacific in what was left of their crippled spacecraft. There would be no more American manned space missions during 1970. When the tensions eased following the successful splashdown, Mayor Daley issued an invitation for the three astronauts to visit Chicago. On May 2nd, the Chicago City Council issued a special proclamation, and astronaut Swigert said, "It's good to be home on Earth."
About 200,000 miles out, the Earth is extremely beautiful. There are no national boundaries, and there are no diverse political regimes. It's just one big Earth. And unknown to us at this time, all the worlds, all the nations of the world were united in prayer for us. It was, I guess, perhaps God's way of saying that indeed we all can live together. The welcome was overwhelming.
All the astronauts agreed. They would go into space again, but the space program was in for danger of its own. In early September, the space agency announced it was cutting back its lunar landing program. The announcement was made by outgoing NASA administrator Dr. Thomas Paine, who said that two lunar missions, Apollo 15 and 19, would be dropped. Paine said that American lunar exploration for the foreseeable future would end with the final Apollo mission in midsummer of 1972, and he explained the reasons for the cutback.
"We've concluded that these decisions must be made now and implemented at once, since we no longer have the capability to prepare in parallel two Apollo spacecraft. Moreover, the lead time involved in crew training, mission planning, and the requirement to match site selections with the enhanced capability of later lunar missions dictated a decision at this time."
The Russians were busy with space flights in 1970. Soyuz 9, with two cosmonauts aboard, became the longest manned space flight in history, almost 18 days in Earth orbit. Luna 16, unmanned, scooped up lunar soil and brought it back to Earth in September. In November, Luna 17 landed an eight-wheel lunar buggy, one that bounced around sending back information. And in December, the Russians sent a space package to the planet Venus. Pollution solution. It's everyone, it's everyone's problem. It looked as though 1970 would be the year of the anti-pollution crusader, and to some extent it was, but it could have been better. April 24th was Earth Day, and across the nation, as in Chicago, there were cleanup campaigns, demonstrations, rallies, and teach-ins, and there was hope. Hope that people would become aware of their environment, that man would learn that his place is within nature and not outside. Even Mayor Daley seemed optimistic as he spoke at a Civic Center rally on Earth Day.
Very shortly, we will begin a pilot program of installing 100 city-owned automobiles, converters to reduce the emission of carbon monoxide and hydrocarbon. We have just written to all of the oil companies, urging them that they distribute rapidly as possible unleaded gasoline.
Illinois equipped herself for the pollution fight with a small army of agency workers ready to set up and enforce anti-pollution standards. President Nixon signed a bill moving pollution-fighting federal agencies under a $1.4 billion roof called the Environmental Protection Agency. Environmentalists lobbied to kill money for a supersonic transport plane. Then, on the day before Thanksgiving, the president took drastic action. Interior Secretary Walter Hickel was ousted from the cabinet.
Really nothing that I can say at this time that would help the situation. And nothing I would say to hurt it. But given the hostility toward me when I first arrived, as you people know so well, and some of those incredible decisions that I had to make immediately thereafter, and trying to do a job for the president and all Americans, and still somehow survive as an individual, I had to do it my way.
In 1968, Hickel had been one of Nixon's strongest backers. He slowly won the support of many environmentalists in his cabinet job. But in the middle of the spreading Indochina war and violence on the nation's campuses, he wrote a letter to the president criticizing him for what he implied was insensitivity to the nation's young people. Leaving before or after the Hickel shakeup were many other Interior Department members, including Assistant Department Secretary Carl Klein, who returned to his suburban Glencoe to resume private law practice. Illinois did take a tremendous step in the question of who has the right to fight pollution. After continual warnings, State Attorney General William Scott announced that Illinois had asked the Supreme Court for permission to sue Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine, Wisconsin, and two municipal sewage agencies. Scott claimed that they were guilty of dumping raw or poorly treated sewage into Lake Michigan, and it was being washed up on Illinois beaches and in drinking water sources.
The battle for pollution, the battle to save Lake Michigan, is a battle of time. We've asked the highest court in the nation to take jurisdiction of this case in order to avoid the drawn-out, slow litigation that would happen to come up through the lower court system.
Names make the news, and these names made news in 1970. Joseph Yablonsky, an official of the United Mine Workers Union, he, his wife, and a daughter were found shot to death in their home near Clarksdale, Pennsylvania. He apparently had been murdered following his bitter attempt to be elected president of the union. P.J. Cullerton, known to his friends as Parky, and his friends were reportedly getting big discounts in their property value assessments. Cullerton's Cook County Assessor's Office came under fire, and under a state legislative subcommittee investigation which folded when the chief witness, Chicago real estate developer Arthur Rubloff, refused to honor a subpoena. Southern Judge Harold Carswell of Florida was rejected by the Senate after being appointed by the president to fill a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. Carswell later ran for the Senate from Florida, but lost. In May, Midwest Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Harry Blackmun was unanimously approved for the Supreme Court job. The tiny breakaway province of Biafra capitulated, ending the 30-month Nigerian civil war that left an estimated 2 million persons dead. Betty Friedan was an organizer of the Women's Liberation Movement. She wanted equal rights for females. And on August 26th, Betty Friedan helped lead Women's Lib Day across the nation.
All kinds of women's groups all over the country will be using this week and August 26th particularly
to point up those areas in women's life which are still not addressed. For example, the question of equality before the law. We are interested in the Equal Rights Amendment. The question of child care centers, which are totally inadequate in the society and which women require if they are going to assume their rightful position in terms of helping and decisions in the society. The question of a woman's right to control her own reproductive processes, that is, laws prohibiting abortion in the state or putting them into the criminal statutes, are things that will be addressing ourselves to.
One highlight of Women's Lib Day in Chicago was the picketing of Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion. 50,000 persons were killed, many instantly, in an earthquake in Peru in May. At least 150,000 were killed when a giant tidal wave washed over parts of East Pakistan. Almost 150 young people died when an avalanche slammed into a dance hall in France. The Kansas City Chiefs took the Super Bowl. The Baltimore Orioles won the World Series. Cassius Clay, alias Muhammad Ali, made a big comeback in the boxing ring. Willie Shoemaker became the winningest jockey in horse racing. UCLA took its fourth straight National College Basketball Championship. Al Unser won the Indy 500. And Bobby Orr led the Boston Bruins to hockey's Stanley Cup. Cairo, Illinois, boiled over several times as a trouble spot of racial tension. They were pleased for a federal investigation, and Governor Ogilvy sent in extra state police and an armored car. Midi skirts were in, then out, then back in again. The mini stayed, and so did the admiring glances from men. Bell bottoms were on men's business suits, and white shirts were few and far between on the streets. In October, Illinois Secretary of State Paul Powell died suddenly at the Mayo Clinic. There was a delay of more than half a day before news of Powell's death was released. Governor Richard Ogilvy was asked for an explanation.
Well, I understand that they found the secretary around noontime. I'm sure that there was some consternation on the part of his associates. I was told they began to look for me yesterday evening, about five or so. I was at a dinner here in Chicago, and we just didn't make connections earlier. About 1:30 was when I got the information. I think they felt that I should be the first to know.
2.5 months after Powell's death, it was revealed that $1.5 million in cash and negotiable securities had been found in Powell's Springfield apartment and in Edwardsville. An investigation was launched. Rock singer Janis Joplin and pop musician Jimi Hendrix died of drugs in 1970. Also gone by New Year's Day were authors John Dos Passos and Earl Stanley Gardner, actor Ed Begley, stripper Gypsy Rose Lee, United Auto Workers President Walter Reuther, philosopher Bertrand Russell, Chicago School Board President Frank Whiston, and football coach Vince Lombardi. Pope Paul undertook a 30,000-mile journey to Asia and the Pacific. A Bolivian painter tried to kill the Pope during his stop in Manila. The 1970 census showed there were more than 204 million Americans, an increase of 13.3% over the 1960 census. The shooting deaths of Chicago Black Panthers Mark Clark and Fred Hampton still made news. They were killed during a pre-dawn apartment raid in late 69, but during 1970, there were three major investigations into that state's attorney's raid. And finally, in this, the age of the second generation of computers, perhaps we should remember the story of the Hungarian man who in 1970 finally got a divorce from his temperamental wife. He went to a computer dating service, and you guessed it, for the $13 fee, the computer dating machine matched him up with his ex-wife. This then was 1970. The events that will be remembered and may shape the lives of those as yet unborn as we look ahead after the dawn of the decade.